This morning, members of the President's Advisory Council entering the chapel through the center doors had to walk around the baptismal font. Sacred obstacles force us to think about what we Christians really believe. In the Old Testament, an angel blocked the path of Balaam to convince him that cursing Israel was not in his best interest. Churches should be cluttered with reminders. We actually learn more from pictures and hymns and statues than we do from sermons. No exceptions allowed for the present effort. Placing massive images of the four evangelists around a prominent crucifix on the east wall would carry the message that the gospel, which is God's power to salvation, is found in its purest and holiest form in the scrolls of the four evangelists. The winged man for Matthew, the winged bull for Luke, the winged eagle for John, and last but not really the least, the winged lion for Mark. That sacred winged squadron never tires in its flight from heaven to the four corners of the earth. In commemoration of St. Mark, a flag like that of the City Republic of Venice, emblazoned with the winged lion, should fly from this chapel's turrets. We content ourselves by putting the cross behind us with the symbol of the four evangelists, and we content ourselves by placing on and near the altar the book of the Gospels, from whose sacred pages the Savior still invites us to himself. With only 16 chapters, Mark is considered insignificant and hence expendable. Since nearly all of Mark is found in Matthew and Luke, no church father thought enough of it to write a commentary on it. The old lectionary series has only two readings from Mark. He is the least credentialed evangelist. Intellectually gifted, he was not made of the stuff of saints and martyrs. Upper-class children are disadvantaged by having advantages. His mother owned property in Jerusalem, and his doting uncle Barnabas was a landowner on Cyprus. Hardly peasants by the standards of the ancient or the modern world, which only knew of two classes, poor and rich. His uncle brought him on that first missionary journey, which brought Christianity to what is now Turkey, a trip which made a certain apostle by the name of Paul the theologian in the church to be reckoned with. The rugged terrain of that region uncovered Mark's undependable character. He went back to sunny Cyprus. Mark could follow Jesus if it did not mean giving up the finer things of life. Barnabas's insistence that Mark be given a second chance divided the first, and one hates to add perhaps the only successful team ministry. Paul owed a personal debt to Barnabas, who had introduced him to the apostles in Jerusalem who really counted. But this was not enough to persuade Paul to change his negative opinion about Mark. And you know the end of the story. Barnabas was right about Mark. He was redeemable. Christianity is all about giving second chances to sinners. The ministry is about giving second chances to those who are not at first convinced that the ministry is for them. Paul did an about-face. He asked Timothy to bring Mark to Rome. And Mark became the disciple of Paul and the protege and the confidant of Peter. A one-time failure became the glue which held together a vanishing apostolic circle. Mark assisted St. Peter in the celebration of the Holy Communion in Rome. It was Mark who assisted in reading the Old Testament and probably the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Peter was the prince of the apostles and still is the prince of the apostles in the way that St. Paul can never be. Peter knew more, knew that the more formal Matthew had overlooked the details of the Lord's life. And Luke's literary eloquence did not compensate for his constructing a gospel out of a scattering of sources. Peter and Peter alone is the indispensable source of gospel tradition. Peter had been with Jesus as nobody else had been. From Peter's sermons, Mark constructed our second gospel. Any document sealed with St. Peter's keys could not be kept out of the New Testament. But even St. Peter's imprimatur did not prevent Mark from going to the back of the line. About 100 years ago, scholars took a second look at Mark, but for the wrong reasons. Its brevity suggested that it offered a simple Christianity. And so the scholars concluded that Mark was the first gospel to be written, going against all tradition of the ancient church. A gospel without a preposterous story about a virgin birth and without the preposterous resurrection appearances of Jesus. A gospel without lengthy discourses like the Sermon on the Mount, which are difficult to understand, or a discourse like the Good Samaritan. This kind of gospel was closer to the truth. Mark offered a really genuine, simple, Protestant Christianity. Here is Christianity the way it should be. A Christianity unburdened with nasty Catholic things like incarnation, sacramental commands, inspired scriptures, authoritative apostles and bishops. Of course, the scholars were dead wrong, and they still are. Mark is not a simplistic, primitive gospel of an emerging Christianity. At the very outset of his gospel, Mark has the demons screaming out of hell to salute Jesus as the Son of God. Mark is the theologian without peer. Only in Mark, and Mark alone, finds the basis for baptism in the cross. Are you willing to be baptized with the baptism that I am about to be baptized? Mark is absolute genius. He weaves the preaching of Peter into the fibers of Matthew and Luke and infuses his treatise on the life of Jesus with the evangelistic zeal of St. Paul. The final product is a gospel of literary and theological brilliance, excelling the other gospels in an unmatched sophistication in style and vocabulary. Mark took the flesh from Matthew and Luke, shaped it with the unbounded enthusiasm of St. Peter's uncontrollable soul, and breathed into this gospel the spirit of St. Paul's conviction that he was not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ because it is God's power to salvation. Mark's gospel is not a Lucan travelogue, and it's not Matthew's catechesis, and it is not John's ethereal, otherworldly theology, which Lutherans so admire. Mark's gospel is what gospel should be, preached gospel, the preaching of Jesus Christ, not in the words of St. Paul, but in the words and the events and the life of Jesus Christ himself. With an appropriate lack of modesty, Mark titled what he wrote, "Look for Yourself, the Beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ," and he was right. Sifting through applications for seminary admission is a sensitive business. A man greatly loved by his home congregation her personal piety may not be fit for the ministry. After a man is accepted to the seminary, he is subjected to continual evaluations, which can create their own distortions, and they provide no guarantee about ministerial caliber. The man whom Paul rejected, Barnabas and Peter accepted. They were right. Paul was forced to change his mind. Mark is attractive to every minister, because in Mark, every minister sees a corner of his own life in which his own commitment to the call of gospel preaching was once uncertain. In their feigned modesty, anonymous writers have an arrogance all of their own. The writer of the book of Hebrews is a case in point. Brilliance hidden behind anonymity. Anonymous writers do not really want to remain anonymous. They deliberately leave fingerprints with the hope that some sleuth, perhaps centuries later, will discover who they really are and then admire them. The account of the rich young man is one large smudge on Mark's gospel. He was qualified to become a disciple of Jesus in every way, especially in regard to his orthodoxy. He loved God, he knew the commandments, and he said he loved his neighbor. And what else is there to Christianity? Only one problem. His attachment to his money did not let him love his neighbor in the way he should. It's the old business. No regular army service, just a weekend's ministry, and 2 weeks of summer classes, preferably by correspondence. Lifestyles and providing the children with the best college education are legitimate reasons for not becoming a minister, at least not full time. Regretfully, the requirements for Christ ministers are more stringent. Sell what you have and give to the poor, and you will find treasure in heaven. Pick up your cross. Come, follow me. And you just don't do this on weekends. Men without total commitment disqualify themselves from the ministry. That young man left with tears in his eyes because he could not do what Jesus had demanded of him, at least then. It is strange that only Mark tells us that Jesus looked at this young man who was trapped by his own indecision about what to do with his money. In spite of his lack of commitment, Jesus loved him. Nowhere else in the Bible, especially in the Gospels, do we have a phrase like this. Jesus looked at him and loved him. No one, no place else. My pastor father thought that this was not the end of the story, and the rich young man came back. He was right. He still is. That man came back. What he wanted for himself became less important than preaching the gospel to the poor. The once outcast Mark became the confidant of the great apostles Peter and Paul. And he wrote a gospel, an honor which was given to only three other men, and he suffered a martyr's death. He was baptized with Christ's baptism, words which he only recorded and which he put into practice. There are other smudges in Mark. Only Mark tells us about a young man who watched the soldiers arrest Jesus, and when they approached him, they grabbed his tunic and he ran away naked. Classic Mark, classic Christian. Commitment to Jesus as long as there is no price to pay. Faith without the embarrassment of Jesus. However, curiosity without commitment does not a Christian make. Then there's another fingerprint, almost imperceptibly tucked away into the corner of a very short Easter story. In the empty tomb of Jesus, a young man is seated in the white garment of baptism, confidently proclaiming to grieving women that the crucified Jesus is no longer there, but he is risen from the dead. Mark, by baptism, had joined Jesus in the martyr's death so that he could share in the glory of Christ's resurrection. Even a church which ignores Mark all year long could not avoid him on Easter. Every Easter, Mark still preaches. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were amazed. And he said to them, "Do not be amazed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him as he told you."